Horses with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Wednesday, race fans. Sirius 219, XM 201, Sports Zone 964. If you're listening to Sirius XM online and at our website, stevebick.com. Midweek, making the transition, not just ahead of the weekend, but actually just finished unpacking from the last month on the road before we leave again Friday. And so I'm in that mode, kind of picking and pruning. The good news is, the one good thing about this trip coming up, it's my own car. I drive to Louisville, Nashville, Baltimore, and home. So I don't have to, you know, there's no flight involved, so you're not limited to 50 pounds in the bag, you know? That's a consideration. Especially for us clothes horses, I really should go get one of those again. They don't make the thing in the back seat the way they used to, with the clip. When I was really on the road, you know, years ago, selling, and I had one of those bars that you hang in the back seat, and you know, you would keep basically, you know, your whole wardrobe in the back seat of the car, hanging there. Yeah. Now you got those handlebars that you can put a good amount of clothes on the. I got a bit. There's a few things that have really triggered the, you know, the excitement and the eagerness, and it's just amazing how many. I started going to Derby in 2001. So 22 years, and every preparation, you know, every advance, getting ready to go, you get excited. It's unusual. Everybody probably has their own version of this for whatever. And a lot of people, I'm sure, that go to Derby every year have the same, you know, that same anticipation. But the opening of Oaklawn, the opening of Keeneland, the opening of Saratoga, the opening of Indiana, of Indianapolis Horseshoe yesterday, and at Fairmont, FanDuel. Big days yesterday, and I'm sure, yeah, every I saw, in fact, Our friend Colleen on Facebook, who's a faithful Fairmont attendee, she sent some video. They had a nice crowd there. Horseshoe, you know, people obviously excited to get the seasons going, and certainly from a wagering standpoint, I'll tell you, a very robust day at both venues. They did $1 million at FanDuel. And close to $3 million at Horseshoe to get things off and running. And of course, speaking of off and running, you needed to be running early yesterday to start this meet at Indy. Yeah, I think there was only one horse that came from, you know, any distance, and that even then it wasn't that far back. You needed to be close. Yeah, it was in the third race, Unpredictable Bay. Kim Hammond and Marcelino Pedroza. At 5-2. I forgot to make mention of this yesterday with the visit from Rachel. But Reinvestment Risk, now 5, made his return as a 5-year-old, and of course has changed hands now with Randy Klopp and, you know, fairly long time, nine starts. But, you know, the multiple grade one placed reinvestment risk. Yeah. In fact, four times, hadn't really thought about that or realized that. Second in the hopeful, second in the champagne, second in the Carter, second in the Churchill Downs handicap last year. Yeah. Beaten by Jackie's Warrior, Speaker's Corner, and Jackie's Warrior the other times as a two-year-old. He did not run well, 4-5, and Unpredictable Bay, and I would not indict him entirely off of this return, because again, although Unpredictable Bay came from, how far back was he? He was 1.5, 3. He was 5 lengths back early, and he ends up winning by a nose over Richard Estevenko, Holiday House. And in fact, Estevenko won on the card. A quick survey. One thing was notable. You had, including the quarter horse race, you had 10 different horsemen winning. Yeah, I mean that opener that produced a big price. The early and late, there were big prices. 31-1 shot, longest shot on the board in the opener. The deputy storm gelding for Scott Mullins starts the meet off with a $65 winner. Yeah, so Scott Mullins and Gennaro Garcia, Kim Hammond, Rudy Brissett, Estevenko was mentioned. Doc Gorham, there was an interesting result in that maiden sprint in the sixth. Dr. Gorham had second to no one in the body of the race. He had Rock the Red stuck out on the AE list. Rock the Red was the 14. He scratched second to no one, but he still needed a second scratch to get in the race. And as it happens, Mullins scratched Star Review, which got Rock the Red into the field because the other AE also, Cowboy Image, had scratched. So Rock the Red comes in off the, you know, off the widow page. You know, when there's a horse or two on the AE and they're not on the main page of your PPs. Yeah, that's the worst. A lot of times those get missed. But Doc Gorham with a win. Bill Morey retained in that maiden open company seventh. You had going through here. Retained Shimmer Me Timbers. Cirillo Gorosjeta wins the allowance eighth feature, and then the allowance nightcap. You had another 11-1, another price for John Herron and Herron Thoroughbreds. This is a with the 7-pound bug, as it happens. Anderson, was there another bug that won on the card? No. Anderson was the only one. And then the sprint, quarter horse, 20-1 shot. But he had some nice pick fives. 129,000 bet into the late pick five, paid 1,400, 1,453. And the early pick five, I know that I absolutely know that Eric Hallstrom was thrilled with this first foray when it came to the first early pick five, just under 100,000. And that was a $1,600 return, thanks to the pricey opener. So off and running at Indy. And since we went in this direction, and before I reach for Dick Powell, let me give you a glance at what happened at FanDuel. And Manny Giles Manny Giles, the 7-pound bug we talked about yesterday with Jim Watkins. Giles with a pair of wins, including the opener on Tizrick. That for John Wainwright to start the meet. Wainwright got the first. Don Bentler won a pair. Ralph Martinez won a pair. And Wainwright won a second race, actually, too. So three trainers with two wins each on the 7-race card. And then, I guess, who was the other? Jerry Butler won the other race. But a 7-race card did $1 million. So good start for FanDuel and for Horseshoe Indy. Wish everybody good luck this season at both venues. That was a fun way to kick things off. Yesterday, also a fun way to kick off what I monikered the Derby Quads. And we'll get at least one today, maybe two, depending if Seth Merrill later. But Dick Powell is going to join us. And, of course, yesterday, if you were listening just now to the replay, John White, John offered you the insights on Forte and Practical Move and Kings Barnes and Dermis Otakaki. And if you saw my tweet earlier, I retweeted Kevin, KK. Make sure you're following Horse Racing KK. Kev's out early every morning, 17 days from Derby. And this morning, an easy half, just a little under, couple of ticks under 50 seconds, easy half for Derma Sotagaki, getting, you know, more and more familiar. You know, they went through the quarantine, he and Continuar, and, you know, now out there working, and I'm sure there'll be a serious work as we get closer for the UAE Derby winner. So yesterday, John gave you those. This morning, Dick is going to look at Mage, Verifying, Tappet Trice, and Angel of Empire. Those will be the Derby Quad insights. And haven't heard from Seth to see if he's... actually, let me look back and see if I've heard from Seth. I have not yet. But Seth, we'll let Seth pick. I'm going to do two fills, Hit Show, Reincarnate, and Skinner. So yeah, we got to keep an eye on the AEs. Can't obscure the AEs. And it's funny, although two fills, of course, was a winner, but the other three, there's a lot to be said when it comes to Derby analysis about the horses that have, you know, I don't want to say excuses. Excuse is not the right word, but excusable or understandable, non-wins. And you know, there's a number of horses coming into this. Confidence Game came up. Who was I talking to? Confidence Game came up, and you know, they had the mile workout the other day. People are going to, you know, be dismissive of Confidence Game. I'll be anxious to see. We'll see. We'll see if maybe see what Seth what horses Seth wants to talk about. But you know, horses like Hit Show, you know, the outposted and ran well in defeat. Reincarnate, who absolutely disappointed. There's no way, you know, coming off the Rebel, where it really felt like, you know, I'm not going to go off into this vein, but I will say, you've heard me kind of moderately scoff sometimes at the notion of, you know, the trouble trip, the trouble horse. Oh, yeah, trouble, yeah, trouble, yeah, trouble. Horses that have trouble, quote unquote, They frequently have trouble on a going basis. There's horses that find trouble, and that's why I, you know, and then invariably when you hear that, they get overbet, invariably, because it you know, it becomes, I mean, sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's not, sometimes it's more subtle, and you know, the best kind of trouble trip is the one no one notices. Right, that's the kind that you can take to the bank, as it were. Let me reach for Dick. I have a tendency sometimes, to go off like this, and there's plenty to talk about. But I want to get Dick Powell in because Dick's going to do that, and I also want Dick to touch on, this CAW conversation that, and I don't know how much of it he heard the last couple of days, but I got nice feedback on the tool, the tools concept, and about surveying the ADW community on the tools that Joe Applebaum had a legitimate point, but also a little bit of a I think I said conciliatory posture. Let me say good morning, Dick Powell.
Steve, good morning. Welcome home.
Thank you. For another 48 hours. We'll launch into this, and there's actually, as I was talking about, these Derby horses, and in this particular case, reincarnate from the Rebel to the Arkansas Derby, and you felt like he was a horse that was supposed to take that step forward in the Arkansas Derby, and if he if he did, that he was going to be a major contender. Instead, he ran okay, disappointing third. But he, garners enough points. He's in this field. And in the fantasy sports world, they call this a post-hype horse, a horse that was built up, disappointed a little, but still may have the talent to impact the next opportunity. So that was a horse I was going to talk about. Skinner, is another one, lightly raced in the hands of John Sheriffs. And, if he gets in, it feels like he's, dangerous. A hit show, people are going to say, oh, couldn't win the wood. The number came back moderate, and people are going to be dismissive of him. So these are the kinds of horses that even Two Phils, who I've liked from early on, there's a horse that people are going to say, well, he won. That it took synthetic for him to win a prep. I look at it a little differently. Anyway, I was trying to find horses for my own purposes and my own Derby quad to that are dirtied up for one reason or another. So two topics for you: your Derby quad horses, as well as your opinion of horses coming off troubled trips. Because I suggest that they get overbet.
Yeah, if it's an obvious trouble trip, they will get overbet because it's going to be in the comment line. It's going to be talked about. The implication is if had it not been for the trouble trip, they would have run a whole lot better. And I agree with what you said a couple of minutes ago, that some horses just find trouble. Trouble finds them. They're just their running style, whatever. They always seem to be into something. So I will look at those type horses. I'd rather find the subtle trouble trip, racing in between horses, having a horse move on your outside so the rider has to respond sooner than they would like. Maybe use up too much energy in that response. To me, that's a trouble trip. You didn't get everything going your own way. And also, when we're looking at trips, we need to recognize the horses that did get the dream trip, that did win and had nothing in their way. And that might not be a true measure of their performance. So you'll hear Andy talk a lot about horses that won with all dressed up, everything went well. Don't expect to see it again unless they were to get the same circumstances again. So, yes, they do get overbet. I wouldn't avoid them per se, but it's just something that I want to see some explosion after you get out of the trouble trip. So, in other words, if you're blocked and steadied, and then suddenly get loose, I want to see some acceleration that's going to indicate that you would have run much better were it not for the trouble. If you just had trouble and that's your excuse, that's just not good enough.
Well, and then especially when you think if you had trouble in a race with 10, 11, or 12, or 8, what are you going to do with 19 around you?
Well, that's what our challenge is every year. We're handicapping a $3 million race, run at a distance they've never tried before, against a field size they will never see again. So the circumstances for the Derby are unique. They're temporary. They're one shot. And it's a lot of extrapolation to get beyond it. So the reality is you got to get lucky. You got to have some luck or an inordinate amount of talent to overcome luck. And then, I don't know. I'm not a big speed figure guy per se, but it just looks like you could throw a blanket over 12 of these horses and have room for a couple more. No one has impressed me in terms of, well, the stupid example I give every year is Zero Mustel and the producers. Dick Shawn gets up to audition and Zero Mustel jumps up and says, "That's our Hitler." And I've yet to see a Derby prep race this year that really where I had anything even close to that reaction. It's some nice horses, and a lot of it is speculation. You're projecting that if a horse is going to do well under these circumstances, they should do even better under these circumstances, and that's part of the handicap and puzzle. Then it all, you know, then they do the post position draw, and then we're really scratching our heads. So it's quite the challenge, and I understand the pools are big, you can make a lot of money and everything else, but unless you had 30, 40 Kentucky Derbies to run every year under these circumstances, this might not be the race to, you know, take out your bankroll and really, really pound it. I know there's all sorts of data about the superfecta average pays this, but then you look at the degree of difficulty. So if I see something, I will bet it. I will spread out. But I don't vary very much, Steve, with my, you know, my win bet, my exacta protectors, things like that. Maybe some pick threes, you know, but I don't change up much. Part of it is just my inability to change, my reluctance to change, and part of it is just, you know, the Derby's over, and you go back through the chart and you look at who are these horses, especially like a year later. How did I like this horse? You know, how did I like More Spirit to win the Kentucky Derby? Just things like that. So I have a jaundiced eye towards it, more cautious than most people heading into it.
Well, speaking of which, as it happens, I don't know what triggered this yesterday, but I did. What was it that made me pull up the charts? Oh, I know what it was. I wanted to pull up last year's card, and I probably have it. I had it anyway. I've got a binder that I keep relevant Derby stuff. But in this case, I was not so much looking for Derby as I was for the undercard and the order of races. And it is interesting that you bring that up, and especially in light of the horses that, you know, that keep coming out, you know, starting their 4-year-old seasons this year, the ones we've already seen, including some that we've seen, you know, regularly as it happens. Simplification, Barber Road the other day with a win. Tis the Bomb, well, all the McPeaks, Classic Causeway, Smile Happy, who's missing? Well, Taba's been back, of course. Messier, you know, who's had a bleeding problem. White Abario's been back regularly. Charge It, who's running this weekend. You know, so on we go. Pioneer of Medina, who popped over the winter already on the return. And here's a horse. Wow. The horse that nobody's going to remember actually even ran in the Derby. Summer is Tomorrow. Summer is Tomorrow. The right? The Seymour Bupat that completely forgot that he even ran in the Derby. Right?
Yeah, it's there's a lot of them, and I like the challenge. I like the mental exercise. I like all of that. As far as betting, I just like the undercard. I like the other races that they're just spectacular to bet on, and the Derby's great to watch. And if you get the one thing I've always said is, if you're gonna pick a winner, pick the winner of the Derby, because you're gonna win 50 times, because every time they show that replay, your horse wins.
I like that.
So if you're gonna have it, it's great. If you run second, you know, if you had Epicenter, if you had some of these heartbreak horses, you get your heart broken every time they show the replay.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. Well, and in fact, I just heard from Seth. Seth is going to do Hit Show. He's going to, even though I said I was going to do Hit Show, he's going to do Hit Show, Sun Thunder, Blazing Sevens, who's uncertain and I would think more doubtful than likely, and Disarm. Those will be Seth's horses. And Dick, you're looking at Angel of Empire, Verifying, Tap It Trice, and Mage, who is waiting to have a rider named Gustavo Delgado. We should let it be known. Javier Castellano signs on for Ben Colebrook and Raise Kane.
Okay, all right. Well, I'll start with Angel of Empire, and what impressed me with him was his ability to go buy horses. In the Ark Derby, he just settled, moved, passed everyone, won hands down. Race before that, an Arisen Star at Fairgrounds, mile and an eighth, same kind of race. Looked good in the final furlong, pulling away. He gets Flavian Pratt, Brad Cox, delivers on the big days, and especially part of it's been we've had quite a few Breeders' Cups in Kentucky lately, but man, Brad shows up in these big races in Kentucky especially. So Angel of Empire comes in. If you can accelerate the way he can, you can take chances and lag behind and then maybe circle, maybe lose a little ground in order to get the clear trip, things like that. But his acceleration is very, very impressive. On Briss, his late pace number in the Ark Derby was just sensational. And if he can replicate that, I think he's a big, big danger. So Angel of Empire, Son of Classic Empire, out of To Honor and Serve. I mean, yes, that is distance dirt breeding. Not the greatest, but you know, it's just we're asking him to do something once, and I think he has the genetic capability to do it. So Angel of Empire, very, very strong contender. Another Brad Cox horse that I like, but back to last year, is Verifying. And he looked great up here, breaking his maiden, 1-10-1, on the pace. And then in the Champagne, that track came up super wet. And he was down on the inside. He was chasing the pace in the stretch. He was still striding well. Weak and late, Blazing Sevens went on to win rather handily. But what I just liked his stride. I liked him reaching out. He handled the track, I thought, okay. And that led to a race in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile where he just got bounced all over the place and just never really had a shot. So Brad brought him back in an allowance race at Oaklawn, won easily. And then in The Rebel, he and Reincarnate had their traffic problem issues, and he never really got a chance to shine, and again on a sloppy track. So he's had two major races that occurred on sloppy tracks. Didn't run bad, but had traffic both times. And then in the Bluegrass, Tyler got him away from the gate, got him up on the pace, and battled Tapper Trice all through the lane. Kind of weakened at the end, but I thought it was just a terrific race on his part. I like Justify. I think the Justifies will be able to handle the added distance. And once again, we got Brad Cox calling all the shots. And I think the Bluegrass was a move forward. And if he has another move forward, which three-year-olds this time of year do have, I think he can be right in. Tapper Trice, I root for Mandy Pope. She has put tons of money into this game. And the fact that she went out and bought this yearling for $1.3 million, and he's now won four straight, including the Tampa Bay Derby, and then battling to beat Verify in the Bluegrass, fantastic. Son of Tappet, I mean, he obviously has terrific stud value at the moment, so she doesn't make up for all those broodmares she bought. But at least, you know, they'll be running in her colors and her and Dean's way. And Louis Saez will be in the irons. And Louis is just terrific in these races, especially when it comes down to a battle of strength. Louis in the stretch is very, very tough. So I think Tapper Trice needs the well-timed move. He showed a little bit better handiness in the Bluegrass where he broke better, stalked, saved ground, had dirt in his face. The Tampa Bay Derby, he was far back, wide. Thought he was lucky to win that race, or maybe it was just a function of not really beating much. But in the Bluegrass, he was much more professional. So he can go in with some level of confidence that he can do that again. And then Mage from Gustavo Delgado won its career debut at Gulfstream in 7 and 122 and 2, which was as fast a 7-furlong maiden race as we had the entire meet. That led to the Fountain of Youth, where he ran into Forte and a bunch of other good horses, had trouble that day, ran kind of one-paced in fourth, and then came back in the Florida Derby and made a big, big move with Louis Saez. Actually had the lead, looked like a winner, and Forte ran him down and pulled away by a length. But Mage was very, very good. I like the pedigree, good magic. I like the Dan Puka, who I think once won a race by 16 lengths. It's some crazy number. Her sire is Big Brown. So we got decent dirt pedigree going long, top and bottom. And that acceleration that he showed in the Florida Derby is what you want to see in the Kentucky Derby. The grinders just tend to have more trouble than the horses that can quicken. And he certainly showed in that race that he can quicken. So he would be a contender. So Angel of Empire and Verifying from the Brad Cox barn. Tapper Trice from Todd Pletcher, and we've seen the other Baffert's, the other Pletcher's, the other whatever's do well in these kind of races. So just because he's not Todd's number one horse, I don't worry about that. And Mage just visually looks like he's getting it together. Spots to feel some experience, but might be getting better at the right time of year.
Excellent. So if we had to, put the moniker on each of the three, the three categories, win candidate, exotic candidate, exclusion.
Yeah. All four win candidates.
All four as win candidates. Interesting.
Yes.
Interesting.
Because I think they all have. That they might not have showed all their cards. My negative with Forte is I feel that we've seen the best of him. And it might be good enough to win the Kentucky Derby. But I don't see another move from Forte, where with these horses, I still think there's some, you know, gas in the tank, or however you want to describe it.
You know, on that topic, Dick, because I have not yet printed the Brisnet PPs, I really should do that. To look at particularly the late pace figures, are his numbers on Briz diminishing with the added distance the way they are on the buyer scale?
No, the overall speed figure, Breeders' Cup Juvenile 100, Fountain of Youth 103, Florida Derby 100. The scary thing is his late pace figures.
Yes.
Breeders' Cup Juvenile 106, Fountain of Youth 102, Florida Derby 96.
Yeah. So he's and that I mean, even though visually, you know, and see, this is what's so funny when you talk about the eye test. The eye test is plays tricks. Because what looks like acceleration from him in the latest stages is actually, you know, horses slowing down that he's catching in this particular case. I mean, he is slowing down less fast than Mage and Cyclone Mischief.
Yes.
So that's why we use figures to measure in this game. That's the employment. In fact, well, you know what? I'll discuss this on the Thoroughgraph front tomorrow with Jeff Franklin as well. Be a good exercise, before the reports start to. Jerry said that maybe this weekend he will have the advance package of Oaks and Derby probables. And their final figures post prep season. Excellent, Dick. I appreciate it. And in fact, I'm gonna have Sid look at Verifying. That's a horse we have not analyzed on pedigree, and it's a fascinating pedigree. It's not too often you see a horse that's inbred to Baldski. How great is that? He's 5x5 to Baldski. That's the only common ancestor in his five generations.
Well, that's a great Florida sire of years ago.
It's an interesting, and both as broodmare sires. Baldski got Voodoo Lily, who dropped Magical Illusion, who, of course, got Stage Magic for John Gunther and Tanya, and she produced Justify. And then on the female family, what's interesting is that Baltsky's in the same position on this page. He was the sire of TNT Gal, who dropped Council's Gal with High Council, who got Tour Hostess, not Your Hostess, by Tour Door, and then Tour Hostess dropped Diva Delight, courtesy of Repent, who you don't see a tremendous amount in pedigrees prominently. A son of Louis Couture's, of course. So Verifying has a very intriguing pedigree, and I'm going to deliver that into Sid's lap next hour.
And it's a big, I call it breeding up. It just wasn't the female family you would expect. They would pay $100,000 and breed to a Triple Crown winner as first crop. That's a bold move on Hunter Valley and Mount Mellick Farms, and it paid off. They got $775 for the colt.
Well, and the mare, you know, she was a very nice stake horse, Diva Delight herself.
Right, but not in my mind, not the commercial flavor of the day. You know, like some of them are.
That's fair.
So to make that move. That's great. The fact that it sold as well as it did, that's great. Passed the beauty contest. He's passing some of the racing contests. He's had a couple excuses, and he, you know, I don't want to get another sloppy track, but at least he's run over sloppy tracks. Won't be the most odd thing in the world for him. But yeah, he's curious, because I when I see that stride, that just sticks with me. And mile and a quarter, there's a point where you just have to have cruising speed. You have to have speed, but you got to be able to carry it without much effort, and I think he has that.
Well, speaking of carrying speed, Dick, let's quickly, because I'm actually surprised how much we the clock just rolls. Let me get, we've only got 3 or 4 minutes. Pick three quickly at Happy Valley. I'm sorry.
Okay. Pouring rain. Been raining on and off, and the sky's just opened up. Looks like it's settled a little bit now. Race seven, we're going 1,200 meters. I narrowed it down to two because I got to spread out in the next leg. So number four, Bundle of Charm, missed by a neck. Last time out, that was with Zach. This time, gets Hugh Bowman, draws post six, should be able to be in that first flight, work out some kind of position. And the favorite's going to be number seven, Magnac, who missed a neck on April 12th. So this horse ran last Wednesday. We had him in our pick three that day. Missed the neck as the beaten favorite. Right back here for Jamie Richards and Zach Purton. So it's 4 and 7 in the first leg. Second leg, race eight, I'm spreading out to four horses. 1, 3, 6, 7. The three is the price horse. Gets in light from a bad post, but he does have speed. So I'm hoping the kid Angus Chung can work out some kind of trip. And he gets 7 pounds off, so he's carrying 126, not the 133 you see. So 1, 3, 6, 7 and race eight, and then heading into race nine, the favorite's going to be the seven, All Greek to Me, missed by a neck in its last start about a month ago. Zach Purton returns for David Hayes, and we'll throw in number three, Lucky Eight, Karis Teen, for Ricky Yu, the red hot Ricky Yu. So, first leg coming up, 4 and 7s. Next leg, 1, 3, 6, 7. Third leg, 3 and 7.
2x4x2. Pick three opportunity right here at the Valley where it's happy. And just looking at odds quickly, Bundle of Charm, 9 to 2. And the seven, Maniac, 3 to 2. So we've got the favorite. We've got a middle price, kind of a long shot. We'll talk in a little bit, Dick, after the race. We'll slip in the weekend recap, and we'll look ahead to the weekend. And we're inching closer to another big Saturday at the end of the month. I know that you're not. I know that the hurdles aren't your absolute favorite. And I should probably completely save it for Sean Clancy tomorrow. But, of course, the Grand National and Aintree on Saturday and at the end of the week. Haven't really had a chance to discuss what went on there. And, in fact, there is the situation with Shark Hanlon that the American connected storyline and kind of a difficult situation. That was horses. I guess the horse, from what I'm seeing, the horse is going to be okay. And they did whatever they needed to do to stabilize him, and that's the good news. And he'll come back to the U.S. And you know, Cape Gentleman, by the way, is the was the horse that that was hurt. So, if you hadn't caught that update, there was also that situation with the horses that ran into the spectator. That was that. If you haven't seen that, that's kind of that was the latest controversy coming out of the Grand National.
Well, I read the Racing Post accounts, watched some interviews, pro and con. I don't think you'll ever see 40 horses in the Grand National again.
Interesting. Corrick Rambler, by the way, your winner, a middle price choice that made some sense. Yeah, we'll let Sean, and actually I should probably get Steve Anderson, who was there. We'll get Steve Anderson back on Friday and get Steve's post-recap. Getting set here, right? We're just about...
Lights flashing, about half loaded.
All right, we will watch. And then I also want you, Dick, did you hear Joe Applebaum with me the other day? Monday?
No.
All right, because I'll frame it and let you just comment, because you've been involved with the kinds of tools that are in players' hands, that get into players' hands. And I had Joe on ostensibly to react to the Dan Ross piece, the California-centric reaction to the CAW topic. And Joe had a couple of interesting, more than a couple of interesting thoughts. Here we go.
Blue and white colors. Starter Mr. Tony Speechley is happy and they're off. Favorite first out, Magniac, but he has Classic Unicorn on his inside with plenty of speed, and right there between horses is Ace One. Nam Jong Sing's going up to be in the first three now from Jolly Ruler, trap wide, then came Red Desert. Next is Bundle of Charm from Kokshi Musu. Two lengths away is Excellent Piers and Solid Shalar is last of all. Classic Unicorn leads half a length over Nam Jong Sing's three wide and Magniac between them. Two lengths away, fourth is Ace One. Then Red Desert, Jolly Ruler. He's covering some ground from Bundle of Charm, Kokshi Musu. Two lengths away, two Solid Charlar and Excellent Piers is last. They've run this at good pace. And with 4:50 to go, Classic Unicorn leads three quarters, Magniac. Nam Jong Sing's is gone. Then Ace One, Red Desert. Jolly Ruler's covered ground from Bundle of Charm. Classic Unicorn sprung off the bend. He still leads. Magniac's there for the fight. Two lengths to Ace One. Bundle of Charm runs on. Magniac's taken over though. 1:25 to go. He's a length and a half over Race 1. Bundle of Charm and Jolly Ruler. But this is going to be a good win. Magniac, he's finding plenty. And he scores and scores well. Magniac beat Ace 1. Bundle of Charm, Jolly Ruler. Good run from him too. He was never on the track. The Excellent Piers, Solid Charla ran on. Followed by Classic Unicorn.
Well, Dick, two very well-employed uses by you to start this sequence, because Bundle of Charm ran very well while losing ground and ended up third in here, but the Magniac was in close attendance, and you worry that the way that race was run that he might be vulnerable late, but no, he actually powered away.
Yeah, when the horse who was third on the outside wasn't able to keep up the pressure, then
yeah,
it was just a matter of time when Zach was going to pounce. That's a three-year-old, Steve.
How about that?
So you're going to see a lot more of this horse. I don't know if he's going to go on, and all his races so far have been 1,200 meters, but they all start at that distance, and some of them make it to the bigger races next year for the four-year-olds. But that's a very impressive three-year-old that had a good form in Australia before shipping in, had three wins down there, now gets a win in Hong Kong after missing by a neck last time out, which was last week. So he's the hot horse.
Nice. Good start. Not a big price, but that's okay. Gets us live to the 1367 in the 8th, which is the Kings Park, and then the nightcap, two horses, the 3 and the 7. So for those of you that punched it up, good luck the rest of the way. I'll keep an eye on it as the morning progresses. Dick Powell with us, and talking HKJC, talking Dick's Derby Quad. These are the four horses that the regulars are each surveying, four horses apiece, and providing some pedigree perspective, some form and style perspective. The one thing, Dick, we didn't get from you, actually, we should revisit, the price quotient. What is an acceptable price on your four horses?
I don't know, number one. Number two, I hate to say I don't care, but I see so many people tell you, oh, I like this horse at 10-1. Well, if he's 8-1, does that count as a winner? And picking, to me, picking the final odds of the Derby might be harder than picking the winner of the Derby. The money just shows up, goes all over the place. A horse will take money and continue to take money. It's like it feeds upon itself as the day goes on, and I can't figure it out. So no, I'm I take what I can get. And I have a sense of value in my head. When the PPs come out, when they do the draw, then I'll have a better understanding. I certainly don't want to be favored with any of these horses. That's why Forte is so important, that you want him to be the talking horse. You want him to work out 59 and change and Todd give two thumbs up. You know, you want everything in his favor so that the others will be fairer value.
All right. That explains why you didn't include the the appropriate numbers. And then we talked about whether win candidates, exotic candidates, or exclusions. Seth will deliver four as well later. Sid Fernando, top of the hour, just minutes away. Jennifer Kelly's going to be here at 10:30 or so, and we'll talk to her about the Foxes of Bel Air, her second foray. I don't know if she's going to do a complete series and revisit every single Triple Crown winner, but so far she has managed to get three between Sir Barton, Gallon Fox, and Omaha. But this book is fabulous because it tells the story, obviously, of Bel Air Stud, the Woodwards, which is a, frankly, you could have done a story about the Woodwards and not even brought up the horses. There's certainly been enough books and things written about William Woodward Sr. and Billy Woodward and everything that that comes with a fateful night in Oyster Bay. How else? I don't know why. I'm not usually trepidatious when it comes to this kind of notorious and salacious topic, but it is a story that was called the murder of the century, the death of the century, the one of those. I mean, just it's a story that doesn't ever seem to lose its legs, right?
Yeah, it's well, who was it that said F. Scott Fitzgerald, the rich are different than us, they have more money. so the reality is they're not different than us. They have the same foibles and craziness and jealousies and all that stuff. Just that they have more money. And then the racing connections have always fascinated me, including the Woodward being the Breeders' Cup Classic. The Woodward was the end-of-season wait-for-age championship.
Yep.
Just had a phenomenal spot on the calendar. And I always point out when people list the great New York breeds of all time, I'm like, hello, Mr. Wright? I mean, not only did Mr. Wright go out to California and win the Santa Anita Handicap, but he won the Woodward against Damascus. And if anyone is bred to win the Woodward, it was Damascus. And Mr. Wright upset him in that race and won three runnings of the Trenton Handicap, which is probably in today's world easily a grade two. So Mr. Wright did it against top horses, but the whole Woodward connection it's one of those deep dives.
Well, and as you know, as murders of the century go, I'm kind of a Evelyn Nesbitt, you know, Harry Thaw, Stanford White. I lean in that direction. That one also has stood the test of time. And for those of you that are hearing about this for the first time, you'll have a fun morning and afternoon if you want to. I'll put up a couple of links. I'll find a couple of good. Jennifer. I mean, obviously that's not the focus, but of the book. But boy, it's certainly chapter worthy. What else are we doing? Seth Merrill will be here, and I think I've got one other visit. And by the way, in addition to Foxes of Bel-Air being discussed today, Dick, are you aware of the new Isaac Murphy biography by Catherine Mooney?
No, I am not.
Isaac Murphy. Catherine Mooney has written The Rise and Fall of a Black Jockey.
Very good. I will look forward to that.
There you go. She'll be on tomorrow. So I wanted to get two books. And there's actually, I've got a couple of different requests from publishers. I clearly have found a, I'm on one of those publicist lists now, it seems. And the books, I mean, these we knew about, but there's a couple of things that are kind of showing up now unsolicited, which is cool.
Well, they know you're going to, you know, they send it to you. It's not going to fall into a black hole. It's going to get looked at.
Good point. Our audience, our listenership, our book consumers, I mean, they respond to the reviews and the suggestions. It's Glennie Kane Oakford was always the funniest, because Glennie would come on, whether it was sales season or, you know, whatever we were doing. There was plenty of occasions to have Glennie on, in the different parts of the year, the two-year-old season, the yearling season, and then the bloodstock sale and September. So every time she would come on, I would mention the Home Run Horse, which had been, I mean, she had published 7, 8, 9 years earlier, and following the horse that turned out to be Vindication. And I would hear from her like 6 weeks later, she would say, I just got a check for, $16 because we must have sold, so they'd sold a dozen books every time she came, and would always make me laugh. Because she said, she'd gone a period of time where the residuals dwindle. So pretty funny. Dick, final topic then for you. And, what came up with Joe Applebaum on Monday as part of that CAW discussion, and you've weighed in, obviously, on the CAW piece, but the portion that we've sort of kind of reacted to on a tangent, Joe made the suggestion that the questions that should be asked, or the question that should be asked individually, is, where are the tools put into the hands and made available to the rank and file horse player to compete? I kind of scoffed, only because compete is kind of a silly suggestion. You're not going to compete with these groups, but level the playing field. You might be able to narrow a gap a little bit, I guess. But it is a fair topic that, the tools that the platforms can offer players. Yesterday, Papo joined us and talked about True Odds available at AmWager and, the stacking, the opportunity to stack wagers and, and enter them into the system, and also conditional wagers, which I think is a topic that needs to be drummed home, that more players should be made aware that they can set conditions, a bet that is triggered, an automatic bet that's triggered based on price at the timing that you choose. And these are, I thought these are valuable points, and I just wanted you, who's seen the rise of the ADW industry and been involved, to weigh in on that.
I'd be curious, just me being cynical, skeptical, whatever. When these tools are available, how often are they used? And I used to ask people, you have trackers on your website, like a racetrack. Yes. How often does it get hit? The answer is like hardly ever. So a tool is only, you know, the hammer only works if you pick it up and use it. So I think the things that Nelson and Papo have done are tremendous because they're kind of mainstreaming something that gets talked about, that, you know, we should take the double probables and compute odds from them and different and other pools as well and blend them in or whatever. But no one does it, and no one's going to do it. It all sounds good until takes the time to do it, and people just don't do it. So having it available is great as that tool. But I don't know. I mean, we're giving the public the ability to bet at the last second. Now, do you get a view of all the other bets and things like that? No, but you can time your bet pretty well. You're not betting 5 minutes of post time. So if you see a horse change odds a lot heading to post time, well, you probably could have waited as long as you possibly could with a smartphone or iPad or anything else like that. So we've given that tool. And that has a big downside, because the more people that use it, the more late odds fluctuations you're going to have, because most of the pool is going to be generated in the last 60 to 90 seconds of wagering. So I don't know. Did Joel have anything more specific? Or
I know that no, he didn't. I know that Joe has been working diligently and for a period of time on something exciting that would fall into this arena. So and even though they aren't necessarily thought of in this regard, there has been innovations for the retail player, whether it's what Scotty McKeever's done with Equine Edge, what John Doyle did with Optics EQ, you know, the ongoing information that Thorograph, the Jerry, you know, Jerry's constantly tinkering and adding you know, quality layers to the Thorograph onion. You know, they're the time form, the pace figure innovations, you know, first Randy Moss and his numbers, and then Craig Melkowski with his, you know, we don't necessarily think of all of that, any innovation that Formulator has instituted, you know, even something, Dick, as simple as you know, the wager pad interface, you know, based on the inputs at Formulator, at AmWager, and you know, TwinSpires and Naira Bets. I mean, there have been a number of innovations, and frankly, in this discussion, I don't think, just occurring to me, I mean, I don't think it's been brought up enough that there's been a number of retail player underpinnings in of recent vintage.
Yeah.
Right? That's fair.
Yes. Yes. I fully agree with that. And I think the don't know how to describe this. An individual player can beat the races better than a computer team can. It's just that you can't beat all the races, which they can. They're betting, as I said, all breeds, all tracks, all races, all pools. Mm. So they're in everything. If you're focusing on, like, I give an example. One of the biggest players I know does not bet the Breeders' Cup. Just will not do it. Too many X factors, too many international shippers, things that don't fit a model, or at least their model, stuff like that. You and I can go over international form and have some pretty good educated opinions on it and do well with them. If you follow two-year-olds, you can do very well with horses that don't have a lot of form. Where the way I describe it is, because horses race less frequently, we're handicapping trainers as opposed to horses. We're handicapping pedigrees as opposed to horses, because the horses don't have that much form to go on. So that's where we might have an edge, or we might have a more level playing field in doing stuff like that.
Well, I agree with that. Being selective and picking your spots and picking an area of expertise, and also and kudos to Andy Serling, who brought this out several years ago as the advent of CAW influence was starting to kind of rear its hoary head, and that sap value first out of the first place it was apparent was in the exactas. And Andy has preached first and foremost that some of the best inequities in a market condition comes an off the turf scenario, which is fascinating in itself, because it's a circumstance that a lot of players turn away, and I see I can't play today, it's off the turf. Well, okay, don't play. Meanwhile, Andy noticed that, I mean, not only are races bet with, you know, as if they're still on the grass very often, but he also noticed that the CAW did not seem to have a capable reaction to off the turf. And as a result, there have been outstanding opportunities in off the turf races, including in multi-race wagers, in doubles and the pickaxe. But particularly in the exactas, which had been sapped thoroughly for value by the programs. So
yep.
There are places where if you're nimble and you're serious about it, you can strike like thunderball.
Yeah. No, I completely agree, and it's part of it is the old, you got to know what you know and also know what you don't know.
Hmm.
And stay away from the stuff you don't know.
There you go. There it is. All right.
Now, I got to leave you with one quick thing,
sure,
and I'll bail out. Damascus was owned by,
yes,
Edith Woodward Bancroft, whose father, William Woodward Sr., owned Belle Estard and won 5 Belmonts in the 1930s.
Yes.
Damascus won the Belmont in 1967 at Aqueduct on a mile and an eighth racetrack. Do I hear 2024, Belma?
That's funny. That's a good point.
And not at Aqueduct, the other mile and an eighth main track.
Oh, look at you. Look at you.
Piecing little, connecting some dots here.
Look at you. You. You're good. You're good. Dick Powell, everybody. HKJC Action. Dick. Thanks, Dick.
Talk to you next week.
You got it. Outstanding. Dick Powell, everybody. And 4 minutes to that next race at Happy Valley. Let's, you know what? No break. It just... this is the way it happens around here. So let's just bring in Sid. I've been texting with Sid back and forth. We've been in contact. Let's see what's going on. Horses coming on the track, actually, coming onto the course at Happy Valley. And I guess we'll take the break at the midway point before we're joined by Jennifer Kelly to talk about the Foxes of Bel Air. That actually, I'm just occurring to me that this is a topic that probably could have thrown Sid's way. The you know, some of the influence of the Bel Air horses through the middle part of the century, all the way up to Damascus. Sid, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Before we go forward, I forgot to mention last week we got to talking about my puppy, and I forgot to give you the kudos of winning the Charles W. Engelhard Jr. Award, which is really a real honor, Steve, and I'll tell you why. It's a Kentucky award given out by the KTOB and the KTA, and usually they give it to, you know, people from Kentucky, I've found, and that's to be expected. And when they give it to somebody outside of Kentucky, it's even more prestigious, to tell you the truth. My good friend Leon Rasmussen, one of the great writers, he never won an Eclipse, but he did win the Engelhard. More recently, people like, you know, Jay Hovde, Jay Privman, they've won it. So you're in excellent company, particularly as you're not from Kentucky. And it's a great honor, really. I was so thrilled for you that you got it.
Well, thank you. And I was on that topic. I mean, I was really I was really touched by it because for that very reason that it you know it just it as I said actually in my remarks I just said to be honored by, you know, the people that it really are the drive train of the sport. That part of it, I really appreciate it. So that was my thinking as well. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking of which, let's talk about some breeders in Kentucky. And Sire Watch Pedigree Focus brought to you by Hill and Dale. Particularly germane in this conversation as this Derby field takes shape. And Hill and Dale kind of holding sway over this breeders, over this Derby field.
They certainly are. And first off, of course, Curlin has Lord Miles, the Woodmill winner. Violence, of course, is last year's champion, two-year-old Forte, as well as Ray's Kane. But probably the most significant development is Curlin's son, Champion's son, first crop three-year-olds. That's Good Magic. He's got three in the qualifiers for the top 20. Mage, Blazing Sevens, a grade one winner last year. We assisted Tracy Farmer with that maiden last year. And Reincarnate. I mean, that's a huge feather in his cap. You know, people want classic horses, and everyone knows, you know, Curlin is the premier classic sire in terms of getting horses that are on the classic trail. And, of course, he's had a couple of classic winners, too, in Exaggerator and Palace Malice. But last year, his first crop son, Keen Ice, got the Derby winner with Brick Strike. And here's another son, Good Magic, who has three, which is really incredible.
From a pedigree standpoint, on that topic, and I'm just pulling my PPs out because I don't have the answer at the ready. At Blazing Sevens, who's uncertain to run. We keep modifying him a little bit.
Because
we don't know if he's
going.
I'm just saying, qualified
in the top 25 points.
Exactly.
Which is really pretty amazing.
That in its own right.
Yeah.
Reincarnate is out of a Scat Daddy mare, which explained why Baffert actually started him on the grass.
Right.
For starters. And Blazing Sevens out of a Warriors Reward mare. And in part, Tracy Farmer, of course, it should be bred Blazing Sevens.
And then
Mage out of the big brown mare, Puka. And what's interesting, particularly about Mage and Blazing Sevens, and go any direction you want with this, Sid, but I mean, Blazing Sevens is probably, if he doesn't run in the Derby, it's over, you know, concerns or thoughts that he's kind of already reached the outer limit, you know, in terms of distance, the mile and the eighth. Then you look at Mage, and if anybody is questioning, you know, his credential, it is because of Puka being, you know, kind of a 7/8 mare. Reincarnate's a little bit different, but you know, revisiting the fact that he's out of a Scat Daddy mare, you know, Scat Daddy gets all kinds. You know, that it just feels like all three of these horses, the question is the mile and the eighth, and who's going to bust through, and you know, who isn't. It's kind of funny, I hadn't really connected those dots.
Yeah. Well, you know, with Curlin, Curlin obviously, I just said, was a classic sire. He was a classic racehorse. You know, his main thing is that he adds a lot of stamina to pedigrees, and he's actually done well with, and we touched upon this last week, he's done great with Seattle Slough Line mares, particularly through AP Indy. But not exclusively. So he does well with more classic blood in him as well. And we'll have to see with Good Magic. He was a champion 2-year-old, and he's built. He's a smaller version. He's a smaller Curlin. In fact. Sometimes in the matings to Good Magic, people try to breed bigger mares. In fact, in the case of Blazing Sevens, for example, his dam is 17.2. That's that Warriors Reward mare. And that kind of fit physically as well as on pedigree when we did the mating for Tracy. Puka, incidentally, was a horse that Jerry Crawford had of Donegal. Jerry also had Keen Ice. It was a horse that we made a best for sale for Jerry because he likes stamina. And so Jerry Crawford, interestingly, has a thumbprint on this as well. With Good Magic, what we're seeing up until this point, up until mile and an eighth race, is that we'll see what happens when they go longer. But he's just getting really high class runners. I mean, and these colts are, you know, think about it. Last year you had a battle for your freshman sire championship, really between Good Magic, Justify, and Bolt Oro. Baldoro has Instant Coffee, who unfortunately didn't make that top 20 on points, but all three of these horses have had good 3-year-olds. Of course, Verifying is by Justify, and the star is Good Magic, which is really, you know, like I said, something that shouldn't be taken lightly, because when you're talking about young stallions, this is how you make a resume. You have a good season with your two-year-olds, and you carry on with your three-year-olds, and hopefully you're getting classic type runners, which is what, you know, everybody wants. And this horse is following that blueprint to a T. And he's doing, with, as you just pointed out, a variety of different mare, other bloodlines and different types of mares. And he looks like he's going to be a, you know, he looks like, well, I mean, he looks right now like the potential successor to Curling.
Yeah, which
and he happens to be at the same farm.
Exactly. Which is the motivation a lot of times, you know, when for people that aren't going to go six figures for stallions have sometimes even two sons at price levels that become approachable. Actually, we'll touch on price levels on stallions and that covering sire topic that we suggested last week in a minute. Looking at this, the way it stands right now, those 20, so six sons of Hillendale Stallions, because there's also, you know, the Raise Cane and Forte, you know, the two Violents, the one Curlin, Lord Miles, and then the three potential Good Magics. And there is actually a second Curlin, of course, in Skinner. Who could still make it.
And think about this. Out of the 18 domestic spots,
that's right.
Two
that's
Japanese
right.
spots. So it's a full one third.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, you know, six out of 18, which is really, really, like I said, something. And Good Magic just had the Tessio winner too, didn't he, last weekend? Another 3-year-old.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And I'm just noting it. Let's see. You know, Tracy sold Blazing Sevens. Grandview sold Mage. Woods Edge sold Reincarnate. Southgate sold Forte. Peter Vexo, that's one homebred. There is the one homebred.
Yeah.
Rockridge Thoroughbreds, not Rockridge, but Rockridge Thoroughbreds, bred and sold Raise Cane. And, you know, and you look at the prices, Violence 50,000 and Curlin, Curlin, of course, is 200 and change. But Violence is 50,000 and Good Magic is 50,000. And basically, as a commercial property, well, Reincarnate sold for $775. Mage sold for $290. Blazing Sevens.
$775 is a 2-year-old, right?
$775 is a 2-year-old. Yep, 2-year-old in training. Blazing Sevens as a Saratoga yearling, $225. Raise Cane, $180 as a Keeneland yearling, and Forte, the bargain, unbelievable. With all the horses that Vinnie Viola and Mike Rapoli bought. $110,000 for Forte.
Yeah.
Amazing. They bought 57 horses and the $110,000. And they've had other nice ones out of this group, but that they're campaigning, but not Forte level. So the point is, whether you're breeding to race like Peter Vexo with Lord Miles, or whether you're breeding commercially to sell, the $50,000 mark when it comes to Violence and Good Magic, kind of a sweet spot, it feels like, Sid.
Yeah, and of course, don't forget these horses were actually cheaper when the foals were conceived, because Good Magic went to start at, I think, $30,000 or $35,000.
Yeah, that's right. That's true.
And
Violence,
you know,
too. Violence had dipped, right?
Yeah, Violence had dipped. And, you know, he was very affordable, maybe $25,000 when these two colts were conceived. So, you know,
you're making me laugh. Whenever Irish War Cry, whenever Mrs. De Tomaso would be asked about choosing curling, she would always point out how I went to Curlin, but I didn't pay $150,000.
That's right. She bet to him when he had dropped the 20.
Yeah, that always made me laugh. She said, I got a bargain. I know a bargain when I see one.
Exactly.
I love it. We're inching closer, and when we talk next week, I'll be coming to you from Churchill, so we'll begin to get excited on that front. And we'll let you monitor and drill down. In the meantime, that topic that came up at the end of the conversation last week, Sid, I don't think we've ever brought this up for those that are making decisions right now, because the breeding season, another month or so, there's people that are saying, you know what, I'm going to call this mare, I'm going to, pick and choose, and I retired a mare, and I'm going to maybe drop this one out of the band, and, what do I do? Who do I cover? I'm sure some are already in full, obviously, from February, March covers, but for those that are going to be making a decision in the next 6 weeks about covering a mare that they're then going to put into a sale in the fall, what advice do you have?
Well, first off, when just the concept that you just brought up, you're going to cull a mare and you want to sell it. So now it becomes a complete commercial proposition. You're not going to be having the foal. So for you, it's not a matter of whether you're going to race the offspring or not. It's purely a commercial proposition of how can you try to maximize the value with the stallion. And as we kind of mentioned this last week, but what you need to do is you're culling the mare because A, she's been a failure in one way or another for you. That's why you're culling her. You don't want to go to a stallion that could be a failure as well by the time you're going to put the mare into the sale. So in other words, you don't want to breed to a fourth crop horse because his two-year-olds might be flops by the time you sell. And so you don't want to have a mare as a failure and a stallion as a failure. Hmm. Right?
Yep.
So what you want to do is, if you take one side of the equation that the mare is somewhat of a failure, you want to get something that's not a failure, which means not proven either success or failure, which means you're talking about a first crop stallion. And then you want to pick a stallion at the right type of stud fee vis-a-vis the value of your mare, because you're gonna get a bump on your mare with a first crop stallion. And I'll tell you what, let's look at a horse like Good Magic, for example. He's by Curlin, right? So perhaps you want to say you have an AP Indy line mare. Perhaps, Curlin has done so well with AP Indy that perhaps you choose a son of Curlin, a first crop son of Curlin. What that does is, at the very basic level, it gives a potential buyer some information that, hey, you know what, this mare is actually bred on a really good cross that's been successful with this horse's sire and his first crop. I could take this mare and sell the yearling. It works all the way down up the ladder. Say a pin hooker might then take a shot on a first crop stallion to sell as a two-year-old that has a good pedigree behind it and one that has a successful cross. So these are some of the things you got to look at down the road, right? And you have to choose a stallion. You don't want to overbreed the stallion, either the mare, because you want to at least get your stud fee plus some premium out of it. So the thing to do is, if it's a $50,000 mare, you probably want to breed it to a $10,000 stallion. and, you know, kind of that way. Not, don't breed your $50,000 mare to a $50,000 stallion, because, you know, you've, now you've got a 50,000 stud fee to recover as well. So you want to try to keep your investment modest enough for you to recover that and have a kick on the mare to sell because there's something positive about it. So those are, you know, it's something that we talk about with our clients all the time, kind of go through. And I think I mentioned an example last week to you. Client had a mare he bought. She lost her first foal. Now, but she was in foal, so he kind of paid a premium for her. She lost the second foal. Mm. Now he's really in a pickle, right? He was going to breed her to a more expensive stallion, but he scaled it down now. And he's chosen a first crop stallion that has some commercial appeal. And so, again, don't realize what you're doing. In this particular case, a cull, meaning you need to sell and want to sell, makes it commercial. So now you have to play the commercial game. But that doesn't mean you have to check your, you know, your brain at the door before you walk in. You want to still produce something that has a chance for success within that parameter, because you're giving it to somebody else, and that's what's going to be attractive to the potential buyer.
Exactly. And you also, what you know, what clues, I mean, there's not a lot of not a lot to go on yet, but you know, watching these early two-year-old races as well, and maybe trying to anticipate who might be a hot sire by November, you know, somebody that...
Well, yeah. Now, if you're doing that, you're not going to a first crop sire. You're going to be going to a, you know,
second
a fifth
or,
crop sire.
Right, further down.
Yeah, so that's another play, too. See, there's various different plays. Now, you can gamble here. If the first option I just gave you was a more of a stronger hedge. Now, you, if you want to gamble, you do exactly what you said. Think. You look at some of the two-year-old sales. If you still have opportunity to breed that mare, see which, you know, sires are selling really well, and then take a gamble by going to a horse that's going to be in his fifth year or fourth year, where he's going to have two-year-olds. You can get to him for a lot cheaper because it's his fourth year at stud. And now you're playing your opinion that I think these two-year-olds are going to hit. So now you go with that, and if they do hit, you got a good bang for your buck. If they don't hit, you get slaughtered, because now you've got a sire that isn't getting two-year-olds, and you've got a mare that's a failure. So these are all the options. It's, you know, it's like Clint Eastwood said when he pointed the Magnum 44 at the guy and said, "You feel lucky, punk." Okay.
Well, do you?
Yeah.
the underappreciated
Harry.
Well, the underappreciated part of that is the bank is the robber saying, "I got to know."
That's right. That's exactly right.
Sid, this was...
So, you know, those are things you go with your, you know, it's just like gambling, playing, you know, horses at the track. How you want to construct your ticket.
That's right.
And do you have a really strong opinion here, and you want to single this fourth crop sire?
Yep.
Yeah.
Take your turn. It's a crap table. But I do like that. I mean, just kind of trying to read the tea leaves and see who's gonna.
Yeah, it's the risk level of various different people. Like, some people might want to try that,
yep.
Especially if they're gonna invest a lower fee to try to hit a bigger score. Then there are other people that want to hedge and have a more of a guarantee that they're not going to really lose. It depends, again, on every individual's position at that time and their level of comfort with risk.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, Sid.
Well, I know you have to go to Jennifer Kelly for her book, so I'll let you go. But that is going to be an interesting book, and you've got the whole Woodwards here, and you're right. You had the older Woodward, then you had the younger Woodward with Nashua, and then
the sister.
Then a period of nothing, and finally Edith Bancroft inherits the famous silks, the polka dot silks, and comes up with Damascus. And it doesn't end there, because then her two sons, the Bancroft sons, the brothers, raised Penny Bryn Farm. And they raised a lot of the offspring of Damascus, Zen, a bunch of them. And Penny Bryn, by the way, the trainer was David Whiteley.
That's it. That's it.
Yeah.
And one of the grandsons comes and visits in New York and still presents the Woodward Trophy.
Yeah.
Which is nice. I asked him, must have been, this is actually a few years ago, and I
he's got an Italian name, doesn't he?
Well, the one
Ventura or something like that.
That's another one too that's done it. I'm thinking of one of the Bancroft. Sons,
right.
And grandsons, and he. I asked him. I said, "How interested are you?" And he said, "I really don't have the bug." I said, "Boy, it would be great. You know, you'd be welcome." And he has small children, because he always brings the now they're probably not so small, they probably in their mid to late teens now, so he said we got the young kids, and so maybe as his kids go off to college and whatnot, maybe we'll get them back in. That's one of the great jackets in the game.
Yeah, no, it really is. It's of course, you know, I'll let Jennifer.
Yeah. They are favorites. I mean, it's a favorite. It's one of the favorite, you know, families and barns, stables, you know, in the game's history, and. It's a little underappreciated. They were kind of a transitional. I'll bring this up with Jen. They were kind of a transitional outfit, you know, from Belmont to Calumet, from Augie Belmont, you know, from the 20s. They emerged in the 30s, and you know, then Calumet, you know, kind of. Particularly on the Triple Crown front, came to dominate. So Jennifer Kelly's making a habit of Triple Crown winning stories. She'll join us next at the races. In the meantime, thanks to Sid, Sirewatch, Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill & Dale. Sid, talk next week.
All right, see you, Steve. Bye.
Sid Fernando. Back after the second half at the races.
At the races with Steve Beck on Sirius XM Radio. Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions, and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Pons family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and curly stands, the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com. Nominate now for Penn National's biggest day of the season, the $400,000 Grade 2 Penn Mile and the $150,000 Penn Oaks will both run Friday, June 2nd, on a card that also includes four Pennsylvania bread stakes, each with a $100,000 purse. Call the racing office at Hollywood Casino at Penn National Racecourse, 800-233-8238. That's 800-233-8238. Nominations close May 17th.
SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick.
And